It really is a very considerable honour to deliver this 40th annual lecture. One of the problems of being 60, as I was a couple of weeks ago, is that you can actually remember very clearly where you were 40 years ago. So 1978 seems remarkably recent to me. In the 37 years I've been involved in business, I've addressed many audiences. But it has to be said that the collective IQ in this room surpasses them all. So this is a very concerning prospect for the boy from Bell Street, a comprehensive schoolboy who gave up science in 1974 and who once scored 8% in a physics exam. Camden began operations in 1919, just 6 years after the Food and Drink Manufacturers Federation, now the FDF, opened its doors. To me, that's not just a fascinating coincidence, but it's a signal that it was in the first part of the 20th century that this country firmly established its preeminent position in food and drink manufacturing, a position which we retain today. Those days also saw the beginning of food and drink regulation, with legislation such as the Milk and Dairies Act of 1914. It covered the production and sale of clean and safe milk for human consumption. Then there was the Food and Drugs Adulterations Act of 1928, which ensured that food was what it said on the tin. Now, since that time, and on those foundations of absolute commitment to food safety, food and drink in the UK has emerged as our largest manufacturing sector. And surely a great part of that is the reassurance and confidence that the public gains from our food safety legislation and from the work on food safety and science that organisations like Camden provides. The direct benefit to consumers of world-leading standards of safety and hygiene is absolutely bankable in the huge financial value of our industry. Today I want to reflect on where that industry finds itself and to look forward to. Now, this seemed a good idea at the time, so I drew my inspiration and my running theme for this speech from popular music. Actually, as I've rehearsed it, it seems a completely stupid thing to have done, because it almost and certainly requires me to sing at one point, and that will have you leaving the room, I can tell you. But I start with Joni Mitchell. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? I arrived at FDF just 3 years ago. I knew a fair bit about beverage alcohol, but I was a real newcomer to this particular part of the food and drink forest. I learned pretty much on my first day the most important soundbite that I had to deploy at every opportunity. Britons today have access to a wider range of safe, nutritious, high-quality food and drink at all price points and in all locations than at any time in their history. Now, as phrases, aphorisms, soundbites go, that's an absolute corker. In fact, given that it is in no sense hyperbolic, it's easy to overlook what a remarkable statement that is and what that says about our industry. Every part of that sentence is true. Access, safe, high quality, nutritious, every price point, every location, than ever before. And therein lies the problem. The typical reaction to that, when I say it, is not, wow, that's amazing, how fantastic. It's, yeah, so what? Too many of us over recent years, too many of the public, too many of the media, and most of all, too many in government, have taken for granted the amazing success story that food and drink in the UK represents. Think about it. Food prices falling year on year? Yes, of course, though not for much longer. Constant innovation and new product development? Absolutely. The UK is the location of choice for food science and research? Taken as read. Constant reformulation to remove salt, sugar, fat, whatever? Naturally. Exports growth every year in double digits? Yes, of course. World-leading low levels of bacterial contamination? Absolutely. Just in time, state-of-the-art food distribution networks? Naturally. Longer shelf lives? Yes, of course. Complex, seamless, integrated supply chains for ingredients, raw materials, part finished and finished goods. No problem. All of it taken for granted by government, by regulators, importantly by investors, by our critics and our detractors, and probably most worryingly, by ourselves. Occasionally, horse meat or fipronil or Russell Hume comes along and provides a wake-up call. But you know, when the fuel drivers went on strike, it first came home to me when the fuel drivers went on strike in 2000, it became starkly clear that without regular deliveries two, three times a day, supermarket shelves would be depleted in 2 days and empty in five. And that happened again 18 months ago when weather conditions caused iceberg lettuces to be in very short and then no supply as a consequence of poor weather in Spain and then in California. Now, a shortage of iceberg lettuces is a real first world problem. It may matter to the Waitrose generation, but it is not necessarily an existential threat to civilization. But it does tell us that we have become completely blasé about the fact that the UK's extraordinary food and drink success story is the natural order of things. But it ain't. At FDF's offices, our meeting rooms are named after dead FDF presidents. One room, and Fiona Kendrick, one room commemorates Sir John Bodinar. Now, Bodinar was a Wiltshire sausage maker. During World War II, the Minister of Food, Lord Wootton, decided that it was important that the war effort was supported by people with business skills and not just by civil servants. And so he replaced the civil servants across the operational parts of the Ministry of Food with business leaders. Bodinar was made head of the supply department at the ministry. Thanks in no small part to his efforts, Britain didn't starve. But it was hard. Wartime rationing was strict. And once hostilities ended, and people forget this, it got stricter still. Rationing was more severe after the war than it was during it. The cold winter of 1946-47 saw potato rationing introduced for the first time. Bread didn't come off rationing until 1948. That's just 70 years ago. In May 1950, rationing ended for canned and dried fruit, for chocolate biscuits, and treacle. In June 1953, get this in the age of Meghan and Harry, in June 1953, everyone was allowed an extra pound of sugar and 4 ounces of margarine with which to celebrate the Queen's coronation. Whoopee. I'm not quite clear what they made with that, actually. In fact, we ought to set that as a test to you, that you've got to decide what you can make with 4 ounces of margarine and some extra sugar. In September 53, sugar rationing ceased. Butter came off the ration in 1954, and finally in May 1954, all rationing ended. Although, curiously, ration cards were reissued in the late 50s as a consequence of shortages driven by the Suez crisis. So somewhere at home, I, 60 years old, have a ration card. It was never used. But it tells you that in a lifetime, you can move from a command and control economy in food and drink to the profusion of choice that we have now. And in that period, you can forget the first and assume that the second is steady state. But those restrictions left a real and lasting legacy on a generation's buying and consumption habits. In particular, it led to a generation being very cautious about the possibility of supply running out. I'll come back to that point a bit later on. So my mum, who died 4 or 5 years ago at the age of 96, and who lived with us in a granny annex, was a woman who never took sugar in her tea, and in the last 10 years of her life, didn't cook. So why was it that when we opened her kitchen cupboards after she died, she had 13 bags of sugar in them? It was kept just in case. I might suggest that next March and April, the British public might be doing something similar, just in case. Even when rationing ended, the food landscape was very different. The government's virtual monopoly on milk had virtually wiped out indigenous British cheese varieties. It was government cheddar or nothing. Refrigerators were uncommon, domestic freezers and microwaves unknown. At least in part, the popularity of US sitcoms like I Love Lucy was not for the comedy, but for the beauty of their domestic appliances. Fresh fruit and vegetables were only available when they were in season, and nobody knew what a polytunnel was. This was an era before celebrity chefs, and even before Fanny Craddock, for whom Johnny didn't arrive with the dishes until 1953. That was a reference that only a very small number of you will have got. She used to say, "Here comes Johnny with the dishes." So you can tell the age of your audience by seeing if they understand that joke. I'm not going to use it again. To these people, John Bodinar, Lord Wootton, Fanny Craddock, even my mum, the 21st century of food is a thing of wonder. So these hard-won triumphs, 60 years of extraordinary progress, have become invisible. How do I know that? Well, if food and drink manufacturing is our largest manufacturing sector, larger than automotive and aerospace combined, why do government ministers always prefer to be associated with automotive, construction, or life sciences in pictures? And that isn't just because they prefer hard hats to hairnets. Why do we continually struggle to find the engineers we need to run our high-tech manufacturing facilities and scientists required to underpin great safety, innovation, and nutrition? And why did it take us 105 years to get a food and drink sector council, giving us a seat alongside government, alongside DEFRA, alongside the Business and Industry Department, and giving us a crack at the possibility of finally, for the first time since 1946, having a national food policy? And finally, why is it that on the BBC website, agriculture is listed as a subtopic of environment and food is listed as a subtopic of health, and neither finds any reference under business? It's tosh, of course, but the simple fact is that our industry is a hidden gem. That's all fine when things are good, but today we face greater challenges than at any time since the Second World War. We're about to change fundamentally our relationship between the UK and its largest trading partner for food and drink, the EU, or at least that's currently the plan. We're also about to change the system by which primary producers, farmers and growers are supposed to deliver food and drink. Together, both have extraordinary implications for how and where we source our talented people, for how we export and import, and how, by whom, and to what standard our food is safely and scientifically regulated. So both our domestic supply of food and drink and our international trade in food and drink face enormous challenges. And we're also facing unprecedented pressure around the impact of the national diet. I accept, indeed, I absolutely campaign on the basis that obesity rates are too high. More concerning is the differential burden of obesity on the least well-off in society. It's far higher than that on the better-off, and it's growing. Obesity is a very complex issue, but the response of politicians and the media is often far too simplistic. Force change in our food and drink, reduce consumer choice, increase price. These are tools which do not work. Third, we've seen in just a few months an extraordinary change in public attitudes to plastics and therefore to plastic packaging. Since food and drink accounts for a large majority of all the plastics used in packaging, about 70%, that in turn presents a massive challenge too. Plastic is an extraordinarily versatile medium, and its use has contributed hugely to better food safety and reduced food waste and extending shelf life. Finding the right balance of plastics will be difficult. And I give you as an example of that, and one that many of you will know, the half cucumber. Now, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert evidently, but as I understand it, most supermarkets find that no rational person can consume a whole cucumber during its life. So the half cucumber has been developed, and it is shrink-wrapped. The choice is, you have either have it wrapped in, I would call it cling film, it almost certainly isn't, or it sits in the fridge unwrapped. Leave it in the fridge unwrapped, and within 2 or 3 days, it's stuck to the back of the appliance and unusable. Wrap it, and it is consumable at high quality for 14 days. And there you have one of the great choices of the 21st century. Plastic waste, packaging waste, or food waste. And so far, we haven't found a way to resolve that. We will work on it, but we need time to resolve those issues. And in that time, we must not be demonized for trying to ensure that food waste is reduced. So we face, in those three challenges, and this is where I use the musical analogy, which I'm already regretting, in the words of Tim Rice's Aladdin, a whole new world, a new fantastic point of view. Of course, whether you see fantastic as a synonym for brilliant or just a description of fantasy rather depends on your point of view. So how should we respond to these challenges? The easy but in no way simple answer is together. One thing which has struck me about our sector since I joined the FTF is how fragmented it is, how atomized it is or has been. We love to segment and compartmentalize ourselves. We love a good niche in food and drink. Primary producers, manufacturers, retailers, food service, catering, out of home, meat, dairy, poultry, food, drink, soft drinks, alcoholic drinks, beer, wine, spirits, cider, adult food, children's food, baby food, specialist nutrition, food containing this ingredient but not that ingredient, food made in this way but not in that way, vegetarian, vegan, flexitarian, what the hell does that mean? The beat goes on. When FDF convenes, and some of you are some distinguished figures in the audience, Chris, nice to see you. When we convene a monthly meeting of food and drink trade associations for an update on Brexit, we quite often have 45 organisations around the table, and we could have 70. Some subsectors of the industry, abattoirs, have 4 different trade associations. None of this is intrinsically bad. I'm actually not criticising it. You can see why it's happened. Individual organisations come to represent the very specific interests of individual subsectors. But it does remind me a lot of Life of Brian and that scene with the People's Front of Judea and the Judean People's Front, where there are no real differences except they bluminate each other. It's a model deeply unsuited to our challenges today. It makes it very hard for us as an industry to speak clearly and consistently and to signal our scale and importance to national life. So we must find a way of celebrating our diversity, but not allowing it to undermine our influence. If we allow ourselves to be divided, we give permission for the industry to be so as well. Now, because FDF is one of the larger and better resourced organisations in the field, we have the ability, and I think more important, the obligation, to be a catalyst for cooperation and progress. And I'm pleased that so many others have come on board with this approach. There is a new era of cooperation across the industry, and it's one of the real silver linings of an otherwise cloud-filled sky. And I make this commitment that as long as I'm leading the FDF, we will work to bring the industry still closer together and make the strongest possible case for the £112 billion sector with 4 million people employed that we are. We must not be ignored. If our new world is to be one in which food and drink prospers, we need to get right our response to those current challenges. So let me set out some of our thinking on the crucial issues we face. Trade, innovation, skills, food regulation and safety, obesity, plastics and packaging. Foreign trade is a lifeblood of the extraordinarily vibrant market in the UK food and drink industry. But only 1 in 5 food and drink businesses export or have exported. So there's a massive opportunity there. Nevertheless, most of them will import ingredients or packaging materials. Consequently, the interests of the food and drink sector can't be left to the 11th hour in the current EU negotiations. I've said many times, but I make no apology for saying it now. Food is a matter of national security. If you can't feed a country, you don't have a country. Government's first duty is to feed its people. If it doesn't feed its people, it has no chance of protecting them and keeping them secure. So our industry and the nation's food security must not be a bargaining chip to secure EU market access for cars or aeroplanes, or worse still, for financial services. The only acceptable outcome to the current EU negotiations for this industry to prosper is continued tariff-free UK-EU trade in all agri-food and drink products. Continued access to EU FTAs during and beyond the transition period, and it was really concerning to see at the weekend that that access is not currently guaranteed. As frictionless as possible trade that avoids delays and added costs, and of course no physical border in Ireland where the majority of goods traded across the north-south border are food and drink. Neither of the two customs models currently under discussion in the government satisfies those criteria. So there's clearly much work to be done to find a model that delivers for industry. Now, I don't want to sound gloomy or depressed, but time has almost run out. Tariffs aside, it's clear that the government must avoid the EU's standard checks on imported food and drink from third countries after we leave the Union. That includes checks of documents, ID, physical inspections, all of which would add substantial delays to deliveries. Now, this particular story is becoming fairly commonplace, but I make no apology for repeating it. At the port of Dover, an average delay of 2 minutes results in a 17-mile queue reaching Ashford within about 4 hours. A 4-minute delay extends that queue to Maidstone. A 6-minute delay, which incidentally is the average time it takes to go across the Norway-Sweden border, which is much quoted as a good example of frictionless trade. A 6-minute delay takes the queue to the M25. And an 8-minute delay in 12 hours sees traffic reaching beyond the Dartford crossing. Make no mistake, the delays would be disastrous for just-in-time supply chains, for movement of limited shelf life products, and, of course, for consumers and shoppers. And imagine the collective stress of all those drivers who are not involved in the food chain. We have to work together with government to find a successful and favourable outcome. Now, that may be before the transition ends on the 31st of December 2020, but it may also be before we leave the Union on the 29th of March next year. If not, if we don't find our own bespoke agreement, the talks will be guided by the EU's standard off-the-shelf trade terms, which aren't designed for trade between near markets or for closely integrated supply chains and value at stake. I recognise the government needs our help because a successful outcome can only be achieved if we present practical and workable solutions for them to table in negotiations. And as an example of our commitment to that, as an industry, we're working hard to do that on the case of rules of origin, the small print in trade deals which help determine if a product can get benefit from a preferential tariff. And I pay tribute to Alex Waugh, my colleague from NABIM, who has led the work on this in a collective effort where we've not only produced the most groundbreaking report across any industrial sector, which is now being used as a template by all industrial sectors, but we're now actually producing the text for the negotiation that government will have for DEFRA working together. It's a remarkable element of cooperation, and it's much down to Alex's personal efforts on this behalf. We've spent a lot of time explaining to policymakers about the high level of integration between the food and drink industry in the UK and the EU. Even relatively simple products contain a myriad of agreements and packaging sourced both sides of the channel, crossing borders multiple times before we arrive at a finished consumer product. The current rules of origin don't reflect the reality of modern manufacturing. They shut out producers, both in the UK and the EU, from preferential trade in the case of an FTA. They're a hidden hard Brexit for our industry. Now, exports are vital for future growth and productivity to the UK food and drink industry. Our total sales overseas are worth more than $22 billion, and we saw a huge increase in 2017 of over 10%. Every quarter, we publish the latest industry export figures, and they continue to show strong growth. But, and it's a big but, they mask the fact that we are significantly underachieving. I used to work for Diageo, the business that produces Johnnie Walker, produces Smirnoff, Tanqueray, and Guinness. Through its spirit sales, Diageo itself represents 10% of the UK's food and drink export value. 10%, one company. That's crackers. We have to do better. Fewer than one in five manufacturers currently export. Regardless of the outcome of the negotiations, this must change, because the EU will always remain our most important trade partner. In fact, our latest figures show that exports to the EU are continuing to grow faster than those with the rest of the world. We're working with government and a broad coalition of industry bodies to secure an ambitious food and drink sector deal as part of the government's industrial strategy. And in the export arena, we want to build on the successful models of Scotland Food and Drink, and particularly of Bord Beer in Ireland, for the whole UK, to address specific gaps in the support that businesses looking to export face. We've set out our plans to boost specialist export support, including access to market research, in-market experts, and to introduce an online portal as a focal point of expertise for exports. We want to target high-value growth opportunities in India, China, Japan, the USA, and the Gulf by introducing dedicated in-market support to address the barriers to trade and build relationships with retailers. We know that through industry action supported by the UK government, we can start to deliver on the potential, but we must start. Alongside exports, investment in innovation and digitization will be pivotal to developing the sector's ambition on productivity growth, allowing us to become the most sustainable industry in the world. We're at the forefront of addressing the health and well-being needs of an aging society. Did you know? This is a factor that absolutely astonished me, that there are 800,000 people in this country, over 65, predominantly over 65, predominantly men, who are malnourished. It's a remarkable thought. They're mostly men who live alone, and for some reason, men are worse at looking after the, well, I guess it's obvious. Men of a particular generation are worse than looking after themselves than women. And that has its own impacts on the health service. We have a lot of information. We hear a lot about the problems that obesity and potentially type 2 diabetes brings to the health service. But the problem that 800,000 malnourished 65-plus-year-olds bring are equally serious, because these are people who do not need to clog up the beds that they do occupy if they were given access to proper nutritional information and proper support in looking after themselves. So the aging population is as much in our minds as young as children faced with the obesity crisis. There are excellent examples of world-class research creating a springboard for solutions which are game-changing in terms of sensing, modeling, simulation and clean room processing as well for longer shelf life. Most of these solutions have led to the use of automation in leading businesses. There's an appetite for all business, from many, many businesses, to move this agenda forward. But there are some barriers. Investment in innovation by manufacturers will benefit the entire food chain. It provides a crucial link for engagement with retailers in the drive for blockchain and other related technological advances. Advanced manufacturing capabilities will enable the delivery of both social and environmental benefits, giving us a vital contribution to growth in the UK economy. The Siemens Made Smarter report outlined a potential £55 billion value for our industry through the adoption of existing digital technology in the next decade. But many companies will need support if they're to exploit these opportunities. So in this arena too, we've set out plans to deliver a step change in engineering of innovation through the adoption of close-in proven technology in this arena. We're going to establish a network of demonstrator sites, enabling stronger collaboration based on existing centres of excellence for food and drink manufacturing. The demonstrator model will support the development of system integration companies with specialist personnel able to work on common challenges and connect industry to cross-disciplinary expertise. So we're looking for active support to promote the use of R&D tax credits to increase claims for the food and drink sector. But to achieve this, we're going to need to invest in people. We've long known that our sector, the manufacturing sector's key strength is the 400,000 people we employ across the UK at all skill levels. These are the key to the future productivity of our industry. But currently, as I said just now, we struggle to recruit the technical experts and the engineers able to support innovation and secure inward investment. We have a shortage of STEM skills, a misperception of the sector as lower skilled, and competition from many other manufacturing sectors. We need 140,000 new recruits by 2024. That challenge is only going to be made more difficult by the challenge to access to labour after Brexit. The industrial strategy sector deal shows the potential for collaboration with government when it's at its best. Not picking winners, but taking a hard-nosed approach to investing behind a robust business case to increase productivity. I hope that soon we can conclude such a deal with the government and move forward. But unfortunately, government isn't always at its best. Around the issues of diet, health, and obesity, we've sometimes seen it at less than optimum performance. Obesity is a scourge. Its prevalence is too high. More worryingly still, the burden of obesity falls almost twice as heavily on lower income groups than on the more affluent. Tackling obesity can never be just about food and drink. Taking measures to change or restrict the supply of food and drink without addressing the factors which influence the demand for food and drink is a recipe for failure. Obesity at its most basic is about excess net energy consumption. It's beyond question that any solution to obesity must therefore command the enthusiastic participation of manufacturers, of producers, of retailers, of the out-of-home sector, and of food service as well. As was said, I'm proud of the work that I did to promote responsible drinking and also to try and lead the industry towards creative new ways of selling alcohol responsibly. I think the Portman Group and the Drinkaware Trust, both of which were substantially contributed to by Diageo, are great examples. I believe FDF's role and the industry's role must not be just to resist poorly thought out or ineffective regulation, which won't work, but to help members and others in the industry understand the climate of public sentiment and to ensure that our behaviours are in step with it. We're committed to working in partnership with government to tackle obesity. Long-standing voluntary work on reformulation around salt has recently been augmented with a focus on sugar and will soon be broadened into a calories and energy programme. While some saw the recent report last week or 2 weeks ago on the first year of sugar reformulation as disappointing, I have to say that I'm quite proud of the progress that's been achieved. We've successfully removed nearly 12% of the nation's salt from its diet, and we've removed 2% of its sugar in a single year, a significant achievement, and much more to come. So far, the shop has been largely overlooked in this. I was rather shocked when one minister I met recently said that if people didn't like the taste of reformulated products, it's just a first world problem and they have to get over it. Actually, it's something else entirely. It represents middle class people telling working class people what to do. That is always wrong. And it's wrong not simply because it's patronising, it's wrong because in the end you end up with all sorts of unexpected consequences when the electorate decides that it rather dislikes that approach and it will do something else. Consumers want more to be done to tackle obesity, but I think we should not assume that consumer consent is infinite as more and more of their favourite products change taste or get smaller. We have to take them with us. Their willingness to allow their choice of food and drink products to be edited without them having a say will be particularly tested if, despite increasing government on food and drink manufacturers, obesity does not fall. So when we call for a holistic approach to obesity, our critics often say this is a diversion. But it's in no one's interest that the public becomes disengaged from this important fight. If they believe the price they're being asked to pay, in some cases literally, is too high for the results they're seeing. So we await the further iteration of the government's childhood obesity plan. It may come as early as this week, or certainly next. We're working with government to help change the food and drink environment, and reformulation is the core of that. Advertising and promotion are not only critical underpinnings of a healthy competitive market, they also allow us to signal new and exciting and healthier variants of food to consumers. To take away that mechanism would, in my view, be perverse. Now, let me come finally to the issue of food safety and regulation. As I said earlier, the UK enjoys a world-class reputation for food safety and standards and for protecting public health. Like many of the unsung successes on which I've reflected, that position has been hard fought and continues to be front and center for many in our sector, whether they be in business, government, or non-government organizations. Trust in food that is safe and that food is what it says on the tin is crucial to our reputation and to public trust. That reputation drives business confidence and the confidence of investors. It enables international trade, whether within the EU or beyond. Other countries trust our regulatory regime to keep their consumers safe as well, and that reputation gives us influence and leadership. So food regulation is an absolute force for good. The current regime is not perfect, but it has so many positives, not least of which is the provision of a level of playing field across the EU. And of course, over the 45 years of EU membership, the UK has been contributing to an evidence-based regulatory framework, inputting expertise and pragmatism that many agree has produced the regulatory environment, which is the leading one in the world. Now, you won't find a regulation on wonky vegetables, much to the disappointment of the Daily Mail, but you will find a lot of important stuff that needs to be lifted and shifted into UK provision once we leave the EU. As we know, regulation and safety are not top of the mind for the general public. They just expect standards will be maintained, and they expect us to keep the same level of standards when we leave the EU. We know sometimes even our industry's high standards fall short, but we've repeatedly shown that we act quickly in response to shortcomings, learn fast, and reinforce processes and procedures. So there's no greater priority for our industry than the safety, quality, and authenticity of UK food and drink. However, nor can we afford to disrupt our trade with our most important markets. And to retain significant levels of trade with the EU, regulatory equivalence is key. We therefore need the minimum possible future divergence from the standards that the EU currently sets until we're confident that the government and the EU27 have the right mechanisms in place to ensure long-term equivalence without impacting on the seamless trade we enjoy today. Fundamentally, regulatory divergence, if it occurs, has to be a two-way process. The UK may choose to diverge, but once we've left the Union, the EU may also diverge from us, and the joint current trajectory, especially without the UK's historically moderating influence over EU regulators, it's important that we recognise how and why this may occur and that we do it in a managed way. Managing access to expertise and advice from existing European bodies like the European Food Standards Agency, got it right, Helen, seems a no-brainer. The pooled expertise that EFSA, got it right again, provides is unparalleled, and there's currently no agency in the UK that could take that responsibility on if the UK were to start diverging. While the FSA and other UK agencies are gearing up for the challenge, until we have an equally robust and independent risk assessment body fully functioning, we must retain UK access to the risk assessment expertise of EFSA. That will help us ensure that future regulation continues to be based on sound science and evidence. I also actually believe there's a mutual benefit in ensuring that the UK continues to have access for intelligence gathering tools, including the Rapid Alert System for Food and Feed, the European Food Fraud Network, and EFSA's Emerging Risks Network. Now, we know the FSA needs to plan for all eventualities, so we support, fully support, it gearing up to take on that risk assessment role and the risk management role that they know they'll have to take on in any event. I've no doubt that if I'd been giving this lecture this time last year when Heather Hancock was standing here, the content would have been considerably different. Last year, we at the FTF decided to focus on three priorities: Brexit, industrial strategy, and diet and health. Since January, we've added a fourth, and since 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, a fifth. Such have been the changes in our industry over the last 12 months. The fourth priority we have added is plastic packaging. Now, many people have conjured with the question, how did plastic become the big issue during the last year? Who would have thought that when DEFRA launched its 25-year environmental plan, that launch would take place at the London Wetlands Centre by none other than the Prime Minister herself? But the work of David Attenborough, Sky TV and others have made this the issue du jour. In the post-Blue Planet 2 era, the environment is centre stage and plastic is at the epicentre. For manufacturers, this upturn in interest poses challenges. Back in 2005, under the auspices of RAP, the Courtauld Commitment was launched, a voluntary agreement aimed at improving resource efficiency and reducing waste within the UK grocery sector. RAP works in partnership with leading retailers, brand owners, manufacturers, suppliers, who sign up and support the delivery of their targets. We're a long-time supporter of the Courtauld Commitment. And looking at our membership as a whole, we continue to show industry-leading dedication to sustainability. Our Ambition 2025 launch last year carried forward the success of an earlier five-fold environmental ambition. The adoption of Ambition 2025 expressed a strong desire to go much further and take strides to shaping future value chains and increasing awareness of the concept of natural capital. But it's fair to say that the current environment, and excuse the pun, sees us looking at some of our current practices and ambitions for change in a whole new light. Much progress has been made in the quality and safety of food, as I said, through highly functional plastic packaging. But it has to be said that plastic packaging is absolutely crucial to product integrity. Our discussions with members on these topics are very lively. Discussions on topics such as deposit return schemes and the reform of producer responsibility schemes have a new sense of urgency and a belief that change will come and come quickly. As an industry, we strongly support these moves, particularly to reduce maritime litter. But current evidence suggests that building on success of schemes like curbside recycling and improving capture rates for packaging consumed on the go offers a sustainable way to increase recycling and reduce littering. The trouble is sometimes they're not spectacular, they don't catch the eye. And we need to take care that all the schemes we're involved work in synergy and that new elements that are brought in are easy to understand and cost effective. We also need to guard against unintended consequences. So a whole new work, and then finally, our fifth challenge, which I mustn't say too much about, not least because some of the some people employed by each business are in the room, is the whole question of Asda Sainsbury. That is a major concern for many in the industry, but it may be that it can be accomplished effectively and without restrictions on competition. I will say just this. It is something that will hold many suppliers in the industry very rapt. It will hold their rapt attention over the next 6 to 8 months, and it will be very interesting to see whether the Competition and Markets Authority proceeds to a full investigation of the proposed merger. So a whole new world of challenges and of opportunities. If we can speak persuasively on those challenges, then we could build a fantastic new world, one in which food is never taken for granted, one in which manufacturing is appreciated for the full economic and cultural and environmental contribution and the contribution to national security that we make. UK food safety and quality will be regarded as a precious, hard-won asset that deserves celebration, protection, and investment. We will cherish the science and engineering that underpins food and drink in this new world as much as other sectors, and the UK's reputation as the best location for international food and drink research and product development will be retained and expanded. The industry would be at ease with a far more flexible model of representation. We'll move to structures that allow us to come together and speak with one voice quickly where the circumstances require it, without compromising the diversity that underpins our success. In this new world, consumers would continue to enjoy the benefits of choice, but overeating and poor diets will be less and less prevalent. Most of us will need to change our lifestyles. I face my own personal obesity crisis every day, and it never gets resolved. I hope industry, government, and NGOs will work as partners to do their bit to nudge that change forward. While government consistently pulls levers around education, planning, and physical activities to support us. I hope too that before long FDF will be regarded as much as a hub as an institution. Of course, we'll continue to represent our members and to make the best possible case for food manufacturing. But I want us to continue to build a myriad of relationships, some formal, some informal, some temporary, some longer term, with other organisations across the industry that allow us to share expertise, to focus on particular issues, to resolve them and go forward. Collaboration needs to be our default model. Separateness, the exception. I want the Food and Drink Sector Council to become a focus for our critical role within government. It has to earn and retain the confidence of government and politicians, but it must demonstrate vigour as well as pragmatism. It must lead the thinking and lead the pace around food and drink issues. Now, I have lots of differences with Michael Gove on policy, but he does command, and he should command your total respect as a clever, well-informed, and bold minister determined to make DEFRA synonymous with action, not something that could be said of most of his immediate predecessors. I like him. I think he's effective. I think he's ambitious. Now, he may have been disappointed not to have been shuffled out of DEFRA, but I'm delighted that he wasn't. I think he gives us clout in the government. He's a big beast, and it is a very long time since Food and Drink had one of those at the cabinet table. He's spoken recently about trade associations, or he said established trade associations, who already have the connections and cash to rig the system in their interest. I'm pretty confident he wasn't referring to FDF, but he is right in the sense that organisations like us and like Camden must never think we know better than our members. To be clear, sometimes our role is to speak for the members when to do so individually might carry risk. The Asda Sainsbury issue might be one of those. But sometimes our role is to get out of the way and provide the opportunity for members to speak themselves. We'll continue to build our relationships with people, with you, across the whole food and drink industry. Many of those will be our friends, but I've always believed that it's important to engage with your critics. So we will speak and listen to them too. If you begin to believe you have a monopoly on wisdom, then it's only a matter of time before you start referring to yourself in the third person. That's why I'm kept off Twitter. We must also balance the interests of larger companies who provide the majority of our revenue and smaller ones who perhaps more accurately reflect the majority of food and drink manufacturers in this country. And I'm struck by one of the unsaid things about my organisation, that it does represent in a most benign way a sort of subsidy from the 20 largest food and drink businesses to many others across the industry. I think that's a good thing, and I'm delighted that our members continue to show that level of responsibility. So that soundbite I mentioned right at the start, which seems hours ago, Britons have access to a wider range of safe, nutritious, high-quality food and drink at all price points and in all locations than at any time of their history. It's worth defending. It's worth celebrating. If we are still able to say it applies in 3 years' time, then I truly believe we will be in a whole new world. And to finish my musical analogy, Tim Rice in Aladdin describes a whole new world as a dazzling place I never knew. Unbelievable sights, indescribable feelings. Some of you probably have those right now, having sat here for an hour listening to me. Indescribable feelings, soaring, tumbling, freewheeling through an endless diamond sky. An endless diamond sky. It's quite a nice way of thinking about the food and drink industry that we have all created and from which we have all benefited. I hope we manage to maintain it. Thank you for listening.